esoteric meaning. He leafed back and forth for a long time. He might as well have come upon a notebook full of Chinese characters. But he grasped the essential of what she was trying to do. She had become fascinated by Fermat's last theorem, a classic riddle. He let out a deep sigh. The last page in the book contained some very brief and cryptic notes which had absolutely nothing to do with math, but nevertheless still looked like a formula. Blonde hulk plus mug equals N-E-B. They were underlined and circled and meant nothing to him. At the bottom of the page was a telephone number and the name of a car rental company in Eskilstuna, Auto Expert. Blomqvist made no attempt to interpret the notes. He stubbed out his cigarette and put on his jacket, set the alarm in the office and walked to the terminal at Slusen, where he took the bus out to the Yuppie Reserve in Steket, near Leinster Sound. He had been invited to dinner with his sister, Annika Blomqvist-Giannini, who was turning 42. Berger began her long Easter weekend with a furious and anxiety-filled 2-mile jog that ended at the steamboat wharf in Salzjubaden. She had been lazy about her hours at the gym and felt stiff and out of shape. She walked home. Her husband was giving a lecture at the Modern Museum, and it would be at least 8 before he got home. Berger thought she would open a bottle of good wine, switch on the sauna, and seduce him. At least it would stop her thinking about the problem that was worrying her. A week earlier she had had lunch with the CEO of the biggest media company in Sweden. Over salad he had set forth in all seriousness his intention to recruit her as editor-in-chief of the company's largest daily newspaper, the Svenska Morgenposten. "The board has discussed several possibilities, but we are agreed that you would be a great asset to the paper. You're the one we want." Attached to the offer was a salary that made her income at Millennium look ridiculous. The offer had come like a bolt of lightning out of a clear blue sky, and it left her speechless. "Why me?" He had been oddly vague, but gradually the explanation emerged that she was known, respected, and a certifiably talented editor. They were impressed by the way she had dragged Millennium out of the quicksand it had been in 2 years earlier. The Svenska Morgenposten needed to be revitalized in the same way. There was an old man atmosphere about the newspaper that was causing a steady decline in the new subscriber rate. Berger was a powerful journalist. She had clout. Putting a woman, a feminist, no less, in charge of one of Sweden's most conservative and male-dominated institutions was a provocative and bold idea. Everyone was agreed. Well, almost everyone. The ones who counted were all on his side.
"But I don't share the basic political views of the newspaper."
"Who cares? You're not an outspoken opponent, either. You're going to be the boss, not an apparatchik, and the editorial page will take care of itself."
He hadn't said it in so many words, but it was also a matter of class. Berger came from the right background. She had told him that she was certainly attracted by the proposal, but that she could not give him an answer immediately. She was going to have to think the matter through. But they agreed that she would give them her decision sooner rather than later. The CEO had explained that if the salary offer was the reason for her hesitation, she was probably in a position to negotiate an even higher figure. A strikingly generous golden parachute would also be included. "It's time for you to start thinking about your pension plan." Her 45th birthday was coming up. She had done her apprenticeship as a trainee and a temp. She had put together Millennium and become its editor-in-chief on her own merits. The moment when she would have to pick up the telephone and say yes or no was fast approaching, and she did not know what she was going to do. During the past week she had considered time and again discussing the matter with Blomqvist, but she had not been able to summon up the nerve. Instead, she had been hiding the offer from him, which gave her a pang of guilt. There were some obvious disadvantages. A yes would mean breaking up the partnership with Blomqvist. He would never follow her to the Svenska Morgenposten, no matter how sweet a deal she or they could offer him. He did not need the money now, and he was getting on fine writing articles at his own pace. Berger liked being editor-in-chief of Millennium. It had given her a status within the world of journalism that she considered almost undeserved. She had never been the producer of the news. That was not her thing. She regarded herself as a mediocre writer. On the other hand, she was first-rate on radio or TV, and above all she was a brilliant editor. Besides, she enjoyed the hands-on work of editing, which was a prerequisite for the post of editor-in-chief at Millennium. Nevertheless, she was tempted. Not so much by the salary as by the fact that the job meant that she would become, without question, one of Sweden's big-time media players.
"This is a once-in-a-lifetime offer," the CEO had said.
Somewhere near the Grand Hotel in Saltsjöbaden, she realized to her dismay that she was not going to be able to turn the offer down, and she shuddered at the thought of having to tell Blomqvist. Dinner at the Janinis was, as always, mildly chaotic. Annika had two children, Monica 13 and Jenny 10. Her husband, Enrico, who was the head of the Scandinavian arm of an international biotech firm, had custody of Antonio, his 16-year-old son from his first marriage. Also at dinner were Enrico's mother Antonia, his brother Pietro, his sister-in-law Eva Lotta, and their children Peter and Nicola, plus Enrico's sister Marcella and her four kids, who lived in the same neighbourhood. Enrico's aunt Angelina, who was regarded by the family as stark, raving mad, or on good days just extremely eccentric, had also been invited, along with her new boyfriend. At the dining-room table, abundant with food, the conversation went on in a rattling mixture of Swedish and Italian, sometimes simultaneously. The situation was made more annoying because Angelina spent the evening wondering out loud, to anyone who would listen, why Annika's brother was still a bachelor. She also proposed a number of suitable solutions to his problem from among the daughters of her friends. Exasperated, Blomqvist finally explained that he would be happy to get married, but that unfortunately his lover was already married. That shut up even Angelina for a while. At 7:30, Blomqvist's mobile beeped. He'd thought he had shut it off, and he almost missed the call as he dug it out of the inside pocket of his jacket, which someone had hung on the coat rack in the hall. It was Svensson.
"Am I interrupting something?"
"Not particularly. I'm at dinner with my sister and a platoon of people from her husband's family.
What's up?"
"Two things. I've tried to get hold of Krista, but he's not answering."
"He's at the theatre with his boyfriend."
"Damn. I promised to meet him at the office tomorrow morning with the photographs and graphics for the book. Krista was going to look at them over the weekend, but Mia has suddenly decided to drive up to see her parents in Dalarna for Easter to show them her thesis. We'll have to leave early in the morning, and some of the pictures I can't email. Could I messenger them over to you tonight?"
"You could. But look, I'm out in Leinster. I'll be here for a while. But I'm coming back into town later. Enschede wouldn't be that far out of my way. I could drop by and pick them up. Would around 11 be okay?"
"That's fine. The second thing, I don't think you're going to like this."
"Shoot."
"I stumbled across something I think I'd better check out before the book goes to the printer."
"Okay, what is it?"
"Zala, spelled with a Z."
"Ah, Zala the gangster. The one people seem to be terrified of and nobody wants to talk about."
"That's him. A couple of days ago I came across him again. I believe he's in Sweden now, and that he ought to be in the list of Johns in Chapter 7.
"Dog, you can't start digging up new material 3 weeks before we go to press."
"I know, but this is a bit special. I talked to a policeman who had heard some talk about Zala. Anyway, I think it would make sense to spend a couple of days next week checking up on him."
"Why him? You've got plenty of other assholes in the book.
This one seems to be an Olympian asshole. Nobody really knows who he is. I've got a gut feeling that it will be worth our while to poke around one more time."
"Don't ever discount your gut feelings," Blomqvist said. "But honestly, we can't push back the deadline. The printer is booked, and the book has to come out simultaneously with a Millennium issue."
"I know," Svensson said, sounding dejected.
"I'll call you later," Blomqvist said.
Johansson had just brewed a pot of coffee and poured it into the table thermos when the doorbell rang. It was just before 9 p.m. Svensson was closer to the door, and thinking it was Blomqvist coming earlier than he had said he would, he opened it without first looking through the peephole. Not Blomqvist. Instead, he was confronted by a short, doll-like girl in her late teens.
"I'm looking for Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson," the girl said.
"I'm Dag Svensson."
"I'd like to speak with both of you."
Svensson automatically looked at the clock. Johansson was curious and came into the hall to stand behind her boyfriend.
"It's a bit late for a visit," Svensson said.
"I'd like to talk about a book you're planning on publishing at Millennium."
Svensson and Johansson looked at each other.
"And who are you?"
"I'm interested in the subject. May I come in? Or shall we discuss it here on the landing?"
Svensson hesitated for a second. The girl was a total stranger, and the time of her visit was odd, but she seemed harmless enough. So he held the door open. He showed her to the table in the living room.
"Would you like some coffee?" Johansson said.
"How about first telling us who you are?" Svensson said.
"Yes, please. To the coffee, I mean. My name is Lisbeth Salander."
Johansson shrugged and opened the table thermos. She had already set out cups in anticipation of Blomqvist's visit.
"And what makes you think I'm publishing a book at Millennium?" Svensson said.
He was suddenly deeply suspicious, but the girl ignored him and turned instead to Johansson. She made a face that could have been a crooked smile.
"Interesting thesis," she said.
Johansson looked shocked.
"How could you know anything about my thesis?" "I happened to get hold of a copy," the girl said cryptically.
Svensson's annoyance grew.
"Now you're really going to have to explain who you are and what you want."
The girl's eyes met his. He suddenly noticed that her irises were so dark that in this light her eyes might be raven black. And perhaps he had underestimated her age.
"I'd like to know why you're going around asking questions about Zala. Alexander Zala," Salander said. "And above all, I'd like to know exactly what you know about him already."
Alexander Zala, Svensson thought in shock. He had never known the first name. The girl lifted her coffee cup and took a sip, without releasing him from her gaze. Her eyes had no warmth at all. He suddenly felt vaguely uneasy. Unlike Blomqvist and the other adults at the dinner party, and despite the fact that she was the birthday girl, Annika Giannini had drunk only light beer and refrained from any wine or aquavit with the meal. So at 10:30 she was stone-cold sober. Since in some respects she took her big brother for a complete idiot who needed to be looked after, she generously offered to drive him home via Enschede. She'd already planned to drive him to the bus stop on Verne de Wegen, and it wouldn't take that much longer to go into the city.
"Why don't you get your own car?"
she complained anyway, as Blomqvist fastened his seatbelt.
"Because unlike you, I live within walking distance of my work, and need a car about once a year. Besides, I wouldn't have been able to drive anyway after your husband started serving spirits from Schöne."
"He's becoming Swedish. 10 years ago it would have been Grappa."
They spent the ride talking as brothers and sisters do. Apart from a persistent paternal aunt, two less persistent maternal aunts, two distant cousins and one second cousin, Mikael and Annika had only each other for family. The 3-year age difference meant that they had not had much in common during their teens, but they had become closer as adults. Annika had studied law, and Blomqvist thought of her as a great deal more talented than he was. She sailed through university, spent a few years in the district courts, and then became the assistant to one of the better-known lawyers in Sweden. Then she started her own practice. She had specialized in family law, which gradually developed into work on equal rights. She became an advocate for abused women, wrote a book on the subject, and became a respected name. To top it off, she had become involved politically for the Social Democrats, which prompted Blomqvist to tease her about being an apparatchik. Blomqvist himself had decided early on that he could not combine party membership with journalistic credibility. He never willingly voted, and on the occasions when he felt absolutely obliged to vote, he refused to talk about his choices even with Berger.
"How are you doing?"
Annika said as they crossed Skurubron.
"Oh, I'm doing fine."
"So what's the problem?"
"What problem?"
"I know you, Mika. You've been preoccupied all evening."
Blomqvist sat in silence for a moment.
"It's a complicated story. I've got two problems right now. One is about a girl I met 2 years ago who helped me on the Venestrom affair and then just disappeared from my life with no explanation. I haven't seen hide nor hair of her in more than a year, except for last week."
Blomqvist told her about the attack on Lundegarten.
"Did you report it to the police?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"This girl is manically private. She was the one who was attacked. She'll have to make the report."
Which Blomqvist expected would not be high on Salander's list of priorities.
"Bull-headed as usual,"
Annika said, patting Blomqvist on the cheek.
What's the second problem?
We're working on a story at Millennium that's going to make headlines. I've been sitting all evening wondering whether I should consult you. As a lawyer, I mean. Annika glanced in surprise at her brother.
Consult me? She exclaimed. That'd be something new.
The story's about trafficking and violence against women. You deal with violence against women, and you're a lawyer. You probably don't work with cases of freedom of the press, but I would be really grateful if you could read through the manuscript before we send it to the printer. There are magazine articles and a book, so there's quite a bit to read. Annika was silent as she turned down the Hammerby Industrial Road and past Seekler Lock. She wound her way down side streets parallel to Nynäsvägen until she could turn up in Skedevägen.
You know, Mikael, I've been really mad at you only once in my whole life.
Is that so? He said, surprised.
It was when you were taken to court by Wennerström and sent to prison for libel. I was so furious with you that I thought I would explode.
Why? I only made a fool of myself.
You've made a fool of yourself many times before, but this time you needed a lawyer, and the only person you didn't turn to was me. Instead, you sat there taking shit in both the media and the courtroom. You didn't even defend yourself. I thought I was going to die.
There were special circumstances. There wasn't a thing you could have done.
All right. But I didn't understand that until later when Millennium got back on its feet and mopped the floor with Wennerström. Until that happened, I was so damn disappointed in you.
There was no way we could have won that trial.
You're not getting the point, big brother. I understand that it was a hopeless case. I've read the judgment. The point was that you didn't come to me and ask for help. As in, hey, little sister, I need a lawyer. That's why I never turned up in court.
Blomqvist thought it over. I'm sorry. I admit it. I should have done that.
Yes, you should have.
I wasn't functioning at all that year. I couldn't face talking to anybody. I just wanted to lie down and die.
Which you didn't do, exactly.
Forgive me. Annika Giannini gave him a big smile.
Beautiful. An apology 2 years later. Okay, I'll happily read through the text. Are you in a rush?
Yes, we're going to the press very soon. Turn left here. Annika parked across the street from the building on Björnborgsvägen, where Svensson and Johansson lived. "This'll just take a minute," Blomqvist said. He jogged across the street to punch in the door code. As soon as he was inside, he could tell that something was wrong. He heard excited voices echoing in the stairwell and ran up the three flights to the apartment. Not until he reached their floor did he realize that the commotion was all around their apartment. 5 neighbors were standing on the landing. The apartment door was ajar.
"What's going on?" Blomqvist said, more out of curiosity than concern.
They all fell silent and looked at him. 3 women, 2 men, all in their 70s, it seemed. One of the women was wearing a nightgown.
"It sounded like shots,"
said a man in a brown dressing gown, who seemed to know what he was talking about.
"Shots?"
"Just now. There was shooting in the apartment about a minute ago. The door was open."
Blomqvist pushed forward and rang the doorbell as he walked into the apartment.
"Doug? Mia?" he called.
No answer. Suddenly he felt an icy shiver run down his neck. He recognized the smell. Cordite. Then he approached the living room door. The first thing he saw was,
Holy Mother of God!
Svensson, slumped beside the dining room chairs in a pool of blood a yard across. Blomqvist hurried over. At the same time he pulled out his mobile and dialed 112 for emergency services. They answered right away.
"My name is Mikael Blomqvist. I need an ambulance and police."
He gave the address.
"What is this regarding?"
"A man. He seems to have been shot in the head and is unconscious."
Blomqvist bent down and tried to find a pulse on Svensson's neck. Then he saw the enormous crater in the back of his head and realized that he must be standing in Svensson's brain matter. Slowly he withdrew his hand. No ambulance crew in the world would be able to save Doug Svensson now. Then he noticed shards from one of the coffee cups that Johansson had inherited from her grandmother, and that she was so afraid would get broken. He straightened up quickly and looked all around.
"Mia!"
he yelled. The neighbor in the brown dressing gown had come into the hall behind him. Blomqvist turned at the living room door and held his hand up.
"Stop there,"
he said.
"Back out to the stairs."
The neighbour at first looked as if he wanted to protest, but he obeyed the order. Blomqvist stood still for 15 seconds, then he stepped around the pool of blood and proceeded warily past Svensson's body to the bedroom door. Johansson lay on her back on the floor at the foot of the bed.
No, not Mia too, for God's sake.
She had been shot in the face. The bullet had entered below her jaw by her left ear. The exit wound in her temple was as big as an orange, and her right eye socket gaped empty. The flow of blood was, if possible, even greater than that from her partner. The force of the bullet had been such that the wall above the head of the bed, several yards away, was covered with blood splatter. Blomqvist became aware that he was clutching his mobile in a death grip, with the line to the emergency centre still open, and that he had been holding his breath. He took air into his lungs and raised the telephone.
"We need the police. Two people have been shot. I think they're dead. Please hurry."
He heard the voice from emergency services say something, but did not catch the words. He felt as if there was something wrong with his hearing. It was utterly silent around him. He did not hear the sound of his own voice when he tried to say something. He backed out of the apartment. When he got out to the landing, he realized that his whole body was shaking and that his heart was pounding painfully. Without a word, he squeezed through the petrified crowd of neighbors and sat down on the stairs. From far away, he could hear the neighbors asking him questions.
"What happened? Are they hurt? Did something happen?"
The sound of their voices echoed as if coming through a tunnel. Blomqvist felt numb. He knew that he was in shock. He leaned his head down between his knees. Then he began to think.
Good God. They've been murdered. They were shot just a few minutes ago. The killer could still be in the apartment. No, I would have seen him.
He couldn't stop shaking. The sight of Johansson's shattered face could not be erased from his retina. Suddenly his hearing came back, as if someone had turned up a volume control. He got up quickly and looked at the neighbour in the dressing gown.
"You," he said. "Stay here and make sure nobody goes inside the apartment. The police and an ambulance are on their way. I'll go down and let them in."
Blomqvist took the stairs three at a time. On the ground floor he glanced at the cellar stairs and stopped short. He took a step towards the cellar. Halfway down the stairs lay a revolver in plain sight. Blomqvist thought it looked like a Colt 45 Magnum, the kind of weapon used to murder Olof Palme. He suppressed the impulse to pick up the weapon. Instead, he went and opened the front door and stood in the night air. It was not until he heard the brief honk of a car horn that he remembered his sister was waiting for him. He walked across the street. Annika opened her mouth to say something sarcastic about her brother's tardiness. Then she saw the expression on his face.
"Did you see anyone while you were waiting?"
Blomqvist asked. His voice sounded hoarse and unnatural.
"No. Who would that be? What happened?"
Blomqvist was silent for a few seconds while he looked left and right. Everything was quiet on the street. He reached into his jacket pocket and found a crumpled pack with one cigarette left. As he lit it, he could hear sirens approaching in the distance. He looked at his watch. It was 11:17 p.m.
"Annika, this is going to be a long night,"
he said, without looking at her, as the police car turned up the street. The first to arrive were officers Magnusson and Olsen. They had been on Nineshagen responding to what turned out to be a false alarm. Magnusson and Olsen were followed by a staff car with a field superintendent, Oswald Mortensen, who had been at Skanstol when the central switchboard had sent out a call for all cars in the area. They arrived at almost the same time from different directions and saw a man in jeans and a dark jacket standing in the middle of the street raising his hand for them to stop. At the same time, a woman got out of a car parked a few yards away. All three policemen froze. The central switchboard had reported that two people had been shot, and the man was holding something in his left hand. It took a couple of seconds to be sure that it was a mobile telephone. They got out of their cars at the same time and adjusted their belts. Mortensen assumed command.
"Are you the one who called about a shooting?"
The man nodded. He seemed badly shaken. He was smoking a cigarette, and his hand was trembling when he put it in his mouth.
"What's your name?"
"Mikael Blomqvist. Two people were just shot in this building a very short time ago. Their names are Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson. Three floors up.
Their neighbours are standing outside the door.
Good Lord, the woman said.
And who are you?
Mortensen asked Annika.
Annika Giannini. I'm his sister,
she said, pointing at Blomqvist.
Do you live here?
No, Blomqvist said. I was going to visit the couple who were shot. My sister gave me a ride from a dinner party.
You say that two people were shot. Did you see what happened?
No, I found them.
Let's go up and have a look, Mortensen said.
Wait,
Blomqvist said.
According to the neighbours, the shots were fired only a minute or so before I arrived. I dialed 112 within a minute of getting here. Since then, less than 5 minutes have passed. That means the person who killed them must still be in the area.
Do you have a description?
We haven't seen anyone, but it's possible that some of the neighbours saw something.
Mortensen motioned to Magnusson, who raised his radio and talked into it in a low voice. He turned to Blomqvist.
Can you show us the way? He said.
When they got inside the front door, Blomqvist stopped and pointed to the cellar stairs. Mortensen bent down and looked at the weapon. He went all the way down the stairs and tried the cellar door. It was locked.
Olsen, stay here and keep an eye on this,
Mortensen said. Outside the apartment, the crowd of neighbours had thinned out. Two had gone back to their own apartments, but the man in the dressing gown was still at his post. He seemed relieved when he saw the uniformed officers.
I didn't let anyone in, he said.
That's good, Blomqvist and Mortensen said together. There seemed to be bloody tracks on the stairs,
Officer Magnusson said. Everyone looked at the footprints. Blomqvist looked at his Italian loafers.
Those are probably from my shoes, he said. I was inside the apartment. There's quite a bit of blood.
Mortensen gave Blomqvist a searching look. He used a pen to push open the apartment door and found more bloody footprints in the hall.
To the right. Dag Svensson's in the living room and Mia Johansson's in the bedroom.
Mortensen did a quick inspection of the apartment and came out after only a few seconds. He radioed to ask for backup from the criminal duty officer. As he finished talking, the ambulance crew arrived. Mortensen stopped them as they were going in.
Two victims. As far as I can see, they're beyond hope. Can one of you look in without messing up the crime scene?
It did not take long to confirm. A paramedic decided that the bodies would not be taken to hospital for resuscitation. They were beyond help. Blomqvist suddenly felt sick to his stomach and turned to Mortensen.
I'm going outside. I need some air.
Unfortunately, I can't let you go just yet.
I'll just sit on the porch outside the door.
May I see your ID, please?
Blomqvist took out his wallet and put it in Mortensen's hand. Then he turned without a word and went outside, where Annika was still waiting with Officer Olsen. She sat down next to him.
Mika? What happened? Two people I liked a lot have been murdered. Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson. It was his manuscript I wanted you to read.
Annika realized that this was no time to ply him with questions. Instead, she put her arm around her brother's shoulders and hugged him. More police cars arrived. A handful of curious nighttime onlookers had stopped on the pavement across the street. Blomqvist watched them while the police started to set up a cordon. A murder investigation was beginning. It was past 3 a.m. by the time Blomqvist and his sister were allowed to leave the police station. They had spent an hour in Annika's car outside the apartment building in Enschede, waiting for a duty prosecutor to arrive to initiate the pre-investigative stage. Then, since Blomqvist was a good friend of the two victims and since he was the one who had found them, they were asked to follow along to Kungsholmen to assist the investigation. There they'd had to wait a long time before they were interviewed by an Inspector Nieberg at the station. She had light blonde hair and looked like a teenager.
I'm getting old, Blomqvist thought.
By 2:30 he had drunk so many cups of police canteen coffee that he was sober and feeling unwell. He had to interrupt the interview and run to the toilet, where he was violently sick. He still had the image of Johansson's face swimming in his head. He drank 3 cups of water and rinsed his face over and over before returning to the interview. He tried to pull himself together to answer all of Inspector Nieberg's questions.
Did Dag Svensson or Mia Johansson have enemies?
No, not that I know of.
Had they received any threats?
Not that I know of.
How would you describe their relationship?
They gave every appearance of loving each other. Dag told me that they were thinking of having a baby after Mia got her doctorate.
Did they use drugs?
I don't know for sure. But I don't think so, and if they did, it would be nothing more than a joint at a party when they had something to celebrate.
Why were you visiting them so late at night?
Blomquist explained that they were doing last-minute work on a book, without identifying the subject.
Wasn't it unusual to call on people so late at night?
That was the first time it had ever happened.
How did you know them?
Through work.
The questions were relentless as they tried to establish the time frame. The shots had been heard all over the building. They had been fired less than 5 seconds apart. The 70-year-old man in the dressing gown, a retired major from the coastal artillery, as it turned out, was their nearest neighbour. He was watching TV. After the second shot, he went out to the stairwell. He had a hip problem, and so getting up from the sofa was a slow process. He estimated that it had taken him 30 seconds to reach the landing. Neither he nor any other neighbour had seen anybody on the stairs. According to the neighbours, Blomquist had arrived at the apartment less than 2 minutes after the second shot was fired. Calculating that he and Annika had had a view of the street for half a minute while she found the right building, parked, and exchanged a few words before he crossed the street and went up the stairs, Blomquist figured there was a window of 30 to 40 seconds, during which time the killer had left the apartment, gone down 3 flights of stairs, dropping the weapon on the way, left the building and disappeared before Annika turned into the street. They had just missed him. For a dizzying moment, Blomquist realized that Inspector Nieberg was toying with the possibility that he himself could have been the killer, that he had only run down 1 flight and pretended to arrive on the scene after the neighbors had gathered, but he had an alibi in the form of his sister. His whole evening, including the telephone conversation with Svensson, could be vouched for by a dozen members of the Giannini family. Eventually, Annika put her foot down. Blomquist had given all reasonable and conceivable help. He was visibly tired and he was not feeling well. She told the inspector that she was not only Blomquist's sister, but also his lawyer. It was time to bring all this to a close and let him go home. When they got out to the street, they stood for a time next to Annika's car.
"Go home and get some sleep," she said.
Blomquist shook his head.
"I have to go to Erika's," he said. "She knew them too. I can't just call and tell her. And I don't want her to wake up and hear it on the news."
Annika hesitated, but she knew that her brother was right.
"So, off to Salzburg," she said.
"Can you take me?"
"What are little sisters for?"
"If you give me a lift out to Nacka, I can take a taxi from there or wait for a bus."
"Nonsense! Jump in and I'll drive you."
Chapter 12. Maundy Thursday, March 24th. Annika Giannini was exhausted too, and Blomquist managed to persuade her to save herself the hour-long detour around the Lennerstad Sound and drop him off in Nacka. He kissed her on the cheek, thanked her for all her help, and waited until she had turned the car and driven off before he called a taxi. It was 2 years since Blomquist had been to Salzburg. He had only been to Berger's house a few times. He supposed that was a sign of immaturity. Exactly how her marriage with Gregor Beckmann functioned, he had no idea. He had known Berger since the early 1980s. He planned to go on having a relationship with her until he was too old to get out of his wheelchair. They had broken it off in the late 1980s when both he and Berger had met and married other people. The hiatus had lasted little more than a year. In Blomquist's case, the consequence of his infidelity was a divorce. For Berger, it led to Beckmann's conceding that their long-term sexual passion was evidently so strong that it would be unreasonable to believe that mere convention could keep them apart. Nor did he propose to lose Berger the way that Blomquist had lost his wife. When Berger admitted having an affair, Beckmann knocked on Blomquist's door. Blomquist had been dreading his visit, but instead of punching him in the face, Beckmann had suggested they go out for a drink. They hit 3 bars in Södermalm before they were sufficiently tipsy to have a serious conversation, which took place on a park bench in Mariatorget around sunrise. At first, Blomquist was sceptical, but Beckmann eventually convinced him that if he tried to sabotage his marriage to Berger, he could expect to see Beckmann come back sober with a baseball bat. But if it was simply physical desire, and the soul's inability to rein itself in, that was okay as far as he was concerned. So Blomquist and Berger had taken up again, with Beckmann's blessing, and without trying to hide anything from him. All Berger had to do was pick up the telephone and tell him she was spending the night with Blomquist when the spirit moved her, which it did with some regularity. Beckmann had never uttered a word of criticism against Blomqvist. On the contrary, he seemed to regard his relationship with his wife as beneficial, and his love for her was deepened because he knew he could never take her for granted. Blomqvist, on the other hand, had never felt entirely at ease in Beckmann's company, a dreary reminder that even liberated relationships had a price. Accordingly, he had been to Salzjöspaden only on the few occasions when Berger had hosted parties where his absence would have been remarked on. Now he stood at the door of their substantial villa. Despite his uneasiness about bringing bad news, he resolutely put his finger on the doorbell and held it there for about 40 seconds, until he heard footsteps. Beckmann opened the door with a towel wrapped around his waist and his face full of bleary anger that changed to astonishment when he saw his wife's lover.
"Hi, Gregor," Blomqvist said.
"Good morning, Blomqvist. What the hell time is it?"
Beckmann was blonde and thin. He had a lot of hair on his chest and hardly any on his head. He had a week's growth of beard and a prominent scar over his right eyebrow, the result of a sailing accident some years before.
"Just after 5, Blomqvist said. "Could you wake Erica? I have to talk to her."
Beckmann took it that since Blomqvist had all of a sudden overcome his reluctance to visit Salzjöspaden, and at that hour, something out of the ordinary must have happened. Besides, the man looked as if he badly needed a drink, or at least a bed, so that he could sleep off whatever it was. Beckmann held the door open and let him in.
"What happened?"
Before Blomqvist could reply, Berger appeared at the top of the stairs, tying the sash of a white terry-cloth bathrobe. She stopped halfway down when she saw Blomqvist in the hall.
"What?"
"Dag and Mia," Blomqvist said.
His face instantly revealed the news he had come to give her.
"No!"
She put a hand to her mouth.
"They were murdered last night. I just came from the police station."
"Murdered?"
Berger and Beckmann said at the same time.
"Somebody got into their apartment in Enschede and shot them. I was the one who found them."
Berger sat down on the stairs.
"I didn't want you to have to hear it on the morning news," Blomqvist said.
It was 6:59 a.m. on Maundy Thursday as Blomqvist and Berger let themselves into the Millennium offices. Berger had woken Malm and Eriksson with the news that Svensson and Johansson had been killed the night before. They lived much closer and had already arrived for the meeting. The coffee-maker was going in the kitchenette.
"What the hell is happening?"
Malm wanted to know. Eriksson shushed him and turned up the volume on the 7 a.m. news. "Two people, a man and a woman, were shot dead late last night in an apartment in Enschede. The police say that it was a double homicide. Neither of the deceased was previously known to the police. The motive for the murders is still unknown. Our reporter, Hanna Olafsson, is at the scene."
"It was just before midnight when the police received a report of shots fired in an apartment building on Björneborgsvägen, here in Enschede. No suspect has yet been arrested. The police have cordoned off the apartment, and a crime scene investigation is underway."
"That was pretty succinct,"
Eriksson said, and turned the volume down. Then she started to cry. Berger put an arm around her shoulders.
"Jesus Christ,"
Malm said to no one in particular.
"Sit down, everyone," Berger said in a firm voice. "Mikael?"
Blomqvist told them what he knew of what had happened. He spoke in a dull monotone and sounded like the radio reporter when he described how he had found Svensson and Johansson.
"Jesus Christ," Malm said again. "This is crazy."
Eriksson was once more overwhelmed by emotion. She began weeping again and made no attempt to hide her tears.
"I'm sorry,"
she said.
"I feel the same way," said Malm.
Blomqvist wondered why he could not cry. He felt only a huge emptiness, almost as though he were anesthetized.
"What we know this morning doesn't amount to very much," Berger said. "We have to discuss two things. First, we're 3 weeks from going to press with Doug's material. Should we still publish it? Can we publish it? That's one thing. The other is a question that Mikael and I discussed on the way here."
"We don't know the motive for the murders," Blomqvist said. "It could be something to do with Dag and Mia's private life, or it could be a purely senseless act. But we can't rule out that it may have had something to do with what they were working on."
A long silence settled around the table. At last, Blomqvist cleared his throat.
"As I said, we're about to publish a story in which we name people who are extremely anxious not to be identified in this connection. Dag started with the confrontations several weeks ago. I'm thinking that if one of them..."
"Wait,"
Erickson said. We're exposing three policemen, at least one of whom works for Seppo and another on the Vice Squad. Then there are several lawyers, one prosecutor, one judge, and a couple of dirty old men journalists. Could one of them have killed two people to prevent the publication?
Well, I don't know the answer to that, Blomqvist said. They all have a hell of a lot to lose, but they're damn stupid if they thought they could quash a story like this by murdering a journalist. But we're also exposing a number of pimps, and even if we use fictitious names, it wouldn't be hard to figure out who they are. Some of them already have records for violent crimes.
Okay, Marm said, but you're making the murders out to be executions. If I'm reading Svensson's story correctly, we're not talking about very bright people. Are they up to pulling off a double murder and getting away with it? How bright do you have to be to fire two shots? Erickson said. We're speculating here about something we know practically nothing about, Berger broke in. But we do have to ask the question. If suppressing Doug's articles, or Mia's dissertation for that matter, was the motive for the murders, then we have to beef up security here in the office. And a third question, Erickson said. Should we go to the police with the names? What did you tell the police last night, Mikhail?
I told them what Dag was working on, but they didn't ask for details, and I didn't give any names.
We probably should, Berger said.
It's not quite that simple, Blomqvist said. Well, you could give them a list of names, but what do we do if the police start asking questions about how we got hold of them? We can't reveal any source who wants to remain anonymous. And that's certainly true of several of the girls Mia talked to.
What a fucking mess, Berger said. We're back to the original question. Should we publish?
Blomqvist held up his hand. Wait. We could take a vote on this, but I happen to be the publisher who's responsible, and for the first time I think I'll make a decision all on my own. The answer is no. We can't publish this material in the next issue. It's unreasonable for us simply to go ahead according to plan. Silence descended over the table. I really want to publish, obviously, but we're going to have to rewrite quite a bit. It was Doug and Mia who had the documentation, and the story was based on the fact that Mia intended to file a police report against the people we were going to name. She had expert knowledge. Have we got any information on this? The front door slammed and Cortez stood in the doorway.
Is it Doug and Mia?
He asked, out of breath. They all nodded.
Christ, this is crazy!
How did you hear about it? Blomqvist said.
I was on my way home with my girlfriend when we heard it on a taxi radio. The police had been asking for information on fares going to their street. I didn't recognize the address. I had to come in.
Cortez looked so shaken that Berger got up and gave him a hug and asked him to join them at the table.
I think Doug would want us to publish his story, she said.
And I agree that we should. Definitely the book. But under the circumstances, we'll have to push back the publication date.
So what do we do? Erickson said. It's not just one article that has to be switched. It's a whole themed issue. The whole magazine has to be remade.
Berger was quiet for a moment, then gave her first tired smile of the day.
Had you planned to take Easter off, Marlene?
She said.
Well, forget it. This is what we'll do. Marlene, you and I, and Krista, we'll sit down and plan a new issue without Doug's material. We'll have to see if we can pry loose a few articles that we'd planned for June. Mika, how much material did you get from Doug?
I've got final versions of 9 out of 12 chapters. I have drafts of chapters 10 and 11. Doug was going to email me the final versions. I'll check my inbox. But I only have an outline of chapter 12. That's the summary and the conclusions.
But you and Doug had talked through every one of the chapters, right?
Yes. And I know what he was planning to write in the last chapter, if that's what you mean.
Okay. You'll have to sit down with the manuscripts, both the book and the articles. I want to know how much is missing and whether we can write whatever Doug didn't manage to deliver. Could you do an objective assessment today?
Blomqvist nodded.
I also need you to think about what we're going to tell the police. What is within limits and at what point do we risk breaking our confidentiality agreement with our sources? Nobody at Millennium should say anything to anyone outside the magazine without your approval.
That sounds good, Blomqvist said.
How likely do you think it is that Doug's book was the motive for the murders?
Or Mia's dissertation. I don't know. But we can't rule it out.
No, we can't. You will have to keep it together.
Keep what together?
The investigation.
What investigation?
Our investigation, damn it!
Berger suddenly raised her voice.
Doug was a journalist, and he was working for Millennium. If he was killed because of his job, I want to know about it. So we, as an editorial team, are going to have to dig into what happened. You'll take care of that part, looking for a motive for the murders in all the material Doug gave us." She turned to Erickson. "Marlin, if you help me outline a new issue today, then Krista and I will do the draft layout. But you've worked a lot with Doug and on other articles in the themed issue. I want you to keep an eye on developments in the murder investigation alongside Mikhail."
Erickson nodded.
"Henry, can you work today?"
"Sure."
"Start by calling the rest of our staff and tell them what's going on. Then go to the police and find out what's happening. Ask them if there's going to be a press conference or anything. We have to stay on top of the news."
"I'll call everyone first. Then I'll run home and take a shower. I'll be back in 45 minutes.
Let's stay in touch all day."
"Right," Blomqvist said. "Are we finished? I have to make a call." Harriet Wanger was having breakfast on the glass veranda of Henrik Wanger's house in Hedeby when her mobile rang. She answered without looking at the display.
"Good morning, Harriet," said Blomqvist.
"Good heavens! I thought you were one of those people who never gets up before 8.
"I don't, as long as I have a chance to go to bed, which I didn't last night."
"Has something happened?"
"You didn't listen to the news?"
Blomqvist gave her a report of the events of the night.
"That's terrible. How are you holding up?"
"Thanks for asking. I felt better. But the reason I'm calling is that you're on Millennium's board and should be informed. I'm guessing that some reporter will discover soon enough that I was the one who found Doug and Mia, and that will give rise to certain speculations. And when it leaks out that Doug was working on a massive expose for Millennium, questions are going to be asked."
"And you think I ought to be prepared? So, what should I say?"
"Tell the truth. You've been told what happened. You're shocked about the murders, but you are not privy to the editorial work, so you cannot comment on any speculation. It's the police's job to investigate the murders, not Millennium's."
"Thanks for the warning. Is there anything I can do?"
"Not right now. But if I think of something, I'll let you know."
"Good. And Mikhail, keep me informed, please."
Chapter 13. Maundy Thursday, March 24th. The responsibility of leading the preliminary investigation into the double homicide in Enschede landed officially on Prosecutor Richard Ekstrom's desk at 7 on the morning of Maundy Thursday. The duty prosecutor of the night before, a relatively young and inexperienced lawyer, had realized that the Enschede murders could turn into a media sensation. He called and woke up the assistant county prosecutor, who in turn woke up the assistant county chief of police. Together they decided to pass the ball to a diligent and experienced prosecutor, Richard Ekstrom. Ekstrom was a thin, vital man, 5 feet 6 inches tall, 42 years old, with thinning blonde hair and a goatee. He was always impeccably dressed, and he wore shoes with slightly raised heels. He had begun his career as the assistant prosecutor in Uppsala, until he was recruited as an investigator by the Ministry of Justice, where he worked on bringing Swedish law into accord with that of the EU, and he acquitted himself so well that for a time he was appointed division chief. He attracted attention with his report on organizational deficiencies within legal security, where he made a case for increased efficiency, rather than complying with the requests for increased resources demanded by certain police authorities. After 4 years at the Ministry of Justice, he moved to the prosecutor's office in Stockholm, where he handled a number of cases involving high-profile robberies and violent crimes. Within the administration, he was taken for a social democrat, but in reality, Ekstrom was uninterested in party politics. Even as he started to attract attention in the media, people in high places had begun to keep their eye on him. He was definitely a candidate for higher office, and thanks to his presumed party affiliation, he had a broad network of contacts in political and police circles. Within the police force, opinion was divided as to Ekstrom's ability. His investigations had not found support among those who were advocating that the best way to promote law and order was to recruit more police. On the other hand, he had excelled at not being afraid of getting his hands dirty when he drove a case to trial. Ekstrom got a briefing from the criminal duty officer about the events in Enschede, and at once concluded that this was a case which would without a doubt create a stir in the media. The two victims were a criminologist and a journalist, the latter a calling Ekstrom either loved or hated, depending on the situation. He had a rapid telephone conversation with the county chief of police. At 7:15, he picked up the phone again and woke Criminal Inspector Jan Bublanski, known to his colleagues as Officer Bubble. Bublanski was off duty over Easter week due to a mountain of overtime he had accumulated during the past year, but he was asked to interrupt his time off and come to police headquarters at once to run the investigation of the Enschede killings. Bublanski was 52, and had been on the force since he was 23. He had spent 6 years in patrol cars and served in both the weapons division and the burglary division before he took additional courses and advanced to the violent crimes division of the county criminal police. By all accounts, he had taken part in 33 murder or manslaughter investigations in the last 10 years. He had been in charge of 17 of these investigations, of which 14 were solved and 2 were considered closed, which meant that the police knew who the killer was, but there was insufficient evidence to bring the individual to trial. In the one remaining case, now 6 years old, Bublanski and his colleagues had failed. The case concerned a well-known alcoholic and troublemaker who was stabbed to death in his home in Bergshamra. The crime scene was a nightmare of fingerprints and DNA traces left over a period of years by several dozen people who had gotten drunk or been beat up in the apartment. Bublanski and his colleagues were convinced that the killer could be found among the man's prodigious network of fellow alcoholics and drug addicts, but despite their intensive work, whoever it was had continued to elude the police. Bublanski's statistics were good in terms of the number of cases he had solved, and he was held in high esteem by his colleagues. But they also considered him a bit odd, partly because he was Jewish. On certain high holy days, he had been seen wearing a yarmulke in the corridors of police headquarters. This had occasioned a comment from a police commissioner soon after retired, who was of the opinion that it was inappropriate to wear a yarmulke in police headquarters, in the same way he found it inappropriate for a policeman to wear a turban on duty. There was no further discussion about the matter. A journalist heard the comment and started asking questions, at which point the commissioner quickly repaired to his office. Bublanski belonged to the Söder congregation and ate vegetarian food if kosher food was unavailable. But he was not so orthodox that he refused to work on the Sabbath. He immediately recognized that the killings in Enschede were not going to be a routine investigation. Ekström had taken him aside as soon as he appeared, just after 8.
"This seems to be a miserable story," Ekström said. "The two who were shot were a journalist and his partner, a criminologist. And that's not all. They were found by another journalist."
Bublanski nodded. That effectively guaranteed that the case would be closely watched by the media.
"And to add a pinch more salt to the wound, the journalist who found the couple was Mikhail Blomqvist of Millennium Magazine."
"Whoops," Bublanski said.
"Well known from the circus surrounding the Venestrom affair."
"What do we know about the motive?"
"So far, not a thing. Neither of the victims is known to us. They seem to have been a conscientious pair. The woman was going to get her doctorate in a few weeks. This case gets top priority."
For Bublanski, murder always had top priority.
"We're putting together a team. You'll have to work fast, and I'll ensure that you have all the resources you need. You've got Fasta and Anderson. You'll have Holmberg. He's on the Rinkeby murder case, but it seems that the perp has skipped the country. You can also draw on the National Criminal Police as required."
"What's Sonia Modig?"
"Isn't she a little young?"
Bublanski raised his eyebrows in surprise.
"She's 39, just about your age. And besides, she's exceedingly sharp."
"Okay. You decide who you want on the team, but do it quickly. The brass are already after us."
Bublanski took that to be an exaggeration. At this hour, the brass would be at breakfast. The investigation formally began with a meeting just before 9, when Inspector Bublanski assembled his troops in a conference room at County Police Headquarters. He studied the group, not altogether happy with its composition. Modig was the one he had the most confidence in. She had 12 years' experience, 4 of them in the Violent Crimes Division, where she had been involved in several of the investigations led by Bublanski. She was exacting and methodical, but Bublanski had observed in her the trait he regarded as the most valuable in tricky investigations. She had imagination and the ability to make associations. In at least 2 complex cases, Modig had discovered peculiar and improbable connections that all the others had missed, and these had led to breakthroughs. She also had a fresh intellectual humour that Boblansky appreciated. He was pleased to have Jerka Holmberg on his team. Holmberg was 55 and originally from Ångermanland. He was a stocky, plain individual who had none of Modig's imagination, but he was, in Boblansky's view, perhaps the best crime scene investigator in the entire Swedish police force. They had worked on numerous investigations together over the years, and Boblansky was convinced that if there was something worth finding at a crime scene, Holmberg would find it. His immediate task would be to take command of the work in the apartment in Enskede. Boblansky hardly knew Kurt Andersson. He was a laconic and solidly built officer, with such a short stubble of blonde hair that at a distance he looked completely bald. Andersson was 38 and had only recently come to the division from Huddinge, where he had spent years dealing with gang crime. He had a reputation for being hot-tempered and tough, which was perhaps a euphemism for the fact that he employed methods that were not quite by the book. 10 years back he had been accused of brutality, but an inquiry cleared him on all counts. In October 1999 he had driven with a colleague to Alby to pick up a hooligan for interrogation. This man had been well known to the police and for some years had terrorized the neighbors in his apartment building. Now, as the result of a tip, he was taken in for questioning in connection with the robbery of a video store in Norsborg. When confronted by Andersson and his colleague, the hooligan pulled a knife, instead of coming along quietly. The other officer collected several wounds to his hands, and then his left thumb was sliced off, before the thug directed his attention to Andersson, who for the first time in his career was obliged to use his service weapon. He fired 3 shots. The first was a warning shot. The second was deliberately aimed but missed the man. No easy matter, since the distance was less than 10 feet. And the third shot hit him in the middle of the chest, severing the aorta. The man bled to death in a matter of minutes. The inevitable inquiry had ultimately cleared Andersson of any wrongdoing, but only solidified his reputation. Boblansky had had doubts about Andersson at first, but after 6 months he had encountered nothing to provoke his criticism or wrath. On the contrary, Boblansky was beginning to have some respect for Andersson's taciturn skill. The last member of the team, Hans Faste, was 47, a veteran of 15 years in violent crimes, and the chief reason for Boblansky's not being totally satisfied. Faste had a plus side and also a minus side. On the plus side, he had extensive experience, and of complicated investigations, too. On the minus side, he was egocentric and had a loudmouth sense of humour that especially bothered Boblansky. But when he was kept on a short leash, he was a competent detective. Besides, he had become something of a mentor for Andersson, who did not seem to object to his personality. Inspector Nyberg of the Criminal Division had been invited to the meeting to report on her interview with the journalist Blomqvist during the night. Superintendent Mortensen was also present to report on what had happened at the crime scene. Both of them were worn out and eager to go home to bed, but Nyberg had already managed to get photographs of the apartment, and these she passed around to the team. After half an hour they had the sequence of events clear. Boblansky said,
"Bearing in mind that the forensic examination of the crime scene is still in progress, this is what we think happened. An unknown person entered the apartment in Enskede, without the neighbours or any other witness noticing, and killed the couple, Dag Svensson and Mia Johansson."
"We don't know yet," Nyberg said, "whether the gun that was found is the murder weapon, but it's at the National Forensic Laboratory and it's top priority there. We found a fragment of a bullet, the one that went into Svensson, relatively intact in the bedroom wall, but the bullet that struck Johansson is so fragmented that I doubt it will help much."
"Thanks for that information. A Colt Magnum is a damned cowboy pistol that ought to be banned outright. Have we got a serial number?"
"Not yet," Mortensen said. "I sent the gun and bullet fragments to NFL by messenger direct from the crime scene. Better for them to take care of it than for me to start handling the weapon."
"That's good. I haven't had time to go to the crime scene yet, but the two of you have been there. What are your thoughts?"
Nyberg deferred to her older colleague to speak for them both. "First of all, we think it was a lone gunman. Second, it was an execution, pure and simple. I got a feeling that someone had very good reason to kill Svensson and Johansson, and he did his job with precision."
"What do you base that on?" Faste said.
"The apartment was neat and tidy. It bore none of the hallmarks of a robbery or assault or anything like that, and only 2 shots were fired. Both hit their intended targets in the head. So it's someone who knows how to handle a gun."
"Makes sense to me."
If we look at the sketch of the apartment, from what we could reconstruct, we think that the man, Svensson, was